its current state for Thursday. I'm Mark Bayshore, 90.5 WKAR. Reach us via email at currentstate@wkar.org. A bunch of very interesting emails in recent days to the program, offering all kinds of insights and advice in response to segments that we've aired recently. Later this hour, we lighten up for summer a bit, learn more about what has to be America's only gizzard fest, right? It has to be. In Potterville, of course, Melissa Benmark explores the ins and outs of the Gizzard Fest, also what's new in farmers' markets here in Michigan, and the important role that bees play in agriculture. I'm sure you know about this, but this is especially important here in Michigan because of all of the fruit that we grow. We will talk with an MSU bee specialist. At the top of the show here on Thursday, back on Monday, our first guest became the first Republican to announce as a candidate for Michigan's U.S. Senate seat to be vacated next year by Democrat Carl Levin, saying that representing the state in the U.S. Senate would be the greatest honor. GOP National Committee woman Terry Lynn Land says she intends to officially become a candidate by the July 1st deadline. The Grand Rapids native served two terms as Michigan's Secretary of State, and in 2009 she explored a bid for governor, then ran alongside Oakland County Sheriff Mike Bouchard as his lieutenant governor candidate. Terry Lynn Land, welcome to Current State.
Hey, great to be with you guys. Thanks for that kind introduction.
That's quite all right. You would be joining a notoriously unpopular group of people in Washington, according to the polls, and that's if you're successful. What makes you want to serve in the U.S. Senate?
Well, as you mentioned, I served as Secretary of State for two terms and in a local office as county clerk. And I've always been honored to serve in government. It's been a passion of mine, being able to bring government and efficiencies and customer service and practical common sense to government. And I always thought it'd be an honor to serve in the federal government. And as you mentioned, Senator Levin announced that he was not going to run for re-election, which opened it up, which I truly appreciate him doing that and giving folks a chance to take a look at it, make those decisions. You know, met with my family, talked with my supporters, and said, you know, is this something that we can do? Can we be successful? Can we win? And we came to the conclusion that we could. And so we are putting together a strategy and campaign and policy team, and we'll be filing by July 1 in order that we can start raising the resources that are needed to run a campaign in Michigan. You know, I love this state. I grew up here. This is a relationship state, and the folks really want to see you, hear you, talk about your vision for Michigan and for our country. And in order to do that, you need to be out there in these wonderful Michigan summers. In order to do that. So we're going to start getting out there and talking to the folks.
Your state party chairman, Bobby Shostak, has said that he expects you'll have competition in the primary. Are you prepared to square off against Congressman Mike Rogers if he decides to run? You previously said he would make a good candidate.
Right. And we've talked. In fact, we talked as early as last week about this, and he knows my interest. We've known each other for a long time. I told him that I truly believed in my time frame that I needed to get out there and talk to the voters and needed to start now. And he understood that. He wished me well, and still he was working on his time frame. And everyone has to make their own decision when they run for office and if they're going to. And I realize that. I've had primaries in the past. I'm not against primaries. Obviously, it's nice not to have one, but I understand that, and it's important because this is a very important race, and it's a very important seat, and it's a very important time in our country. So we will be out there talking to voters. Now, as you know, the Democratic establishment has picked one candidate already, and that's fine, but it's important that we get out there and talk about our vision.
We've tried a number of times lately, unsuccessfully, to schedule Congressman Rogers for this program. I have to ask you, though, if he enters, you would stay in the race?
And I told him that, yes.
Okay.
I gave him, you know, a few months. He'd asked for a few months to make a decision, and a few months turned into more months. And I'd said early on when Senator Levin had announced his retirement that I truly felt that you had to get in this race by the summer. And summer is upon us. And as time wore on and more people I talked to, and talked about the opportunities to serve our great state, I realized that I could bring a lot. And I think one of the things that I bring is my management experience. I'll tell you, between the IRS and the Attorney General's office and what's going on there, I mean, we need some accountability, some transparency, some oversight. As Secretary of State, we put all of our information online. We put our budget, we put our spending, our revenue. And if you have that transparency, I truly believe you can have successful government services. The bureaucracy has gotten so large and so huge that you really don't have that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm the kind of person that's a walking around management style. In fact, when I was county clerk, we do vital records. And what had happened was, is my customers were telling me it was hard to get any information from Lansing, from their vital records division, in a timely manner. So I literally called up a state representative. We got in the car, drove to Lansing, and went and met with the director and said, "What's going on?" Well, when we saw his operation, which was direly in need of some technology and upgrades, the legislator realized that they needed to upgrade this department to deliver services to the customers in the state of Michigan. So they did that. And then as Secretary of State, I actually used some of the resources from the Help America Vote Act to upgrade the systems for death records with community health so those could get online and be more useful and more efficiently used by the citizens of Michigan. So to me, that's something that needs to be done, and I think I bring that skill set.
Tell us more about where on the political spectrum you are. Do you consider yourself a Rick Snyder Republican? Do you think of yourself as a Tea Party Republican? What?
I consider myself a conservative and somebody who appreciates liberties and freedoms, and that's where I've always been. And those freedoms include being able to have access to services that are important to families out there. But number one in all of this is definitely jobs. I mean, the number one issue and what people talk to me about most when I'm out there is, and what's important to them, is being able to have a job, being able to have a stable economy, been able to provide for their families. That's the number one issue, no doubt. And government shouldn't be in the way of that. They should be helping that. And that's always been my philosophy. You know, I'm a very common sense, practical type of person, and I understand that, you know, there's different ways. Like families, we have different opinions, but we all want the same thing. So there's different ways to get there, and we need to listen. In fact, I think that's one of the attributes that you're going to need in the next U.S. Senator is somebody who's going to listen and hear the folks out there and what their ideas are and how we can come together to create that economy, create those jobs, and to create a stable place for our families to grow.
You enjoy significant support in West Michigan, where you're from. What do you say to moderates, centrists, and even Democrats, part of that coalition that helped elect Rick Snyder? What do you have to say to those Michigan voters?
Well, the same thing. I mean, they want jobs, they want a stable economy, and they want to be able to provide their families, and they want a government that works. And they want transparency and accountability. As Secretary of State, you know, I ran twice and was able to, receive more votes than the governor received. And in order to do that, I had to get independent votes. In fact, Michigan is becoming more independent, more people consider themselves independents than actually Democrats or Republicans. So anyone who runs in Michigan has to appeal to the independent voter out there. And in order to do that, circling back here, it means you need to get out and talk to them. And that's why it's so critical that you get out this summer, talk to the voters, tell them where you are and your issues, and share your vision for Michigan and the country.
There is a great deal of discussion, much of it quite critical, on what the Republican Party stands for right now and how it needs to change. Most recently on Monday, a study from the College Republican National Committee tore into the party's views on social and economic issues and its messaging. RNC Chairman Reince Priebus had similar comments back in March. Do these issues need work? And if so, how much?
Well, as an RNC member, I'm brand new. I just got on last year. And one of the things that I've talked to the chairman about, Mr. Reince Priebus, Chairman Priebus, is about our communications and how we get our message across. And it can't be the way we've done it in the past. And I agree with that, is we have to get out there. As you know, I'm on Twitter, Facebook, and the Internet, website at terrylinland.com. And putting that transparency and accountability out there, I think, is critical. And Governor Snyder has done that, too. He's put out his dashboards And again, those are things that, you know, the young folks are used to getting information at their fingertips. I have a 24-year-old son and a 27-year-old daughter, And they literally have a question, they just pick up their phone and figure out the answer. And when they have government that blocks their answers, that's not good.
Well, what about the answers themselves, though? I mean, for example, the CRNC report says the GOP, quote, will face serious difficulties so long as the issue of gay marriage remains on the table, unquote. What's your position on same-sex marriage?
Well, my position is that marriage is between one man and one woman. Some folks have talked about that it's a states' rights position, and that's something that, is something to be discussed. But that is my position. But it also is that we have to understand that everybody should have the same rights to get a job, to be able to be respected in our community, to be able to, live a life that they can be productive and that they will not be discriminated against. So those are real issues that we need to talk about, and I think that's something that we haven't done. So, again, when I talked to Chairman Priebus about that, he understands that, and I think that's why the Growth and Opportunity Project, which they put out earlier this year, addresses some of those issues. And I have that on my website, so you can take a look at all that, too.
Do you support efforts at immigration reform?
Well, I'll tell you, as someone who's worked in government and did the enhanced driver's license here in Michigan, the Department of State, which is one of the oldest agencies in our country, which handles all of that, is very archaic. And it should be an easier situation to get through the system, and it isn't. Not that it should be easy to become a U.S. citizen, but this process should be simple. And it needs to be worked on in order to make that happen. And a lot of people get frustrated because they just don't know what to do or where to go. And unfortunately, that puts them in a situation that is not good. There's a reason they're called illegal. We do not want that, but we also want to encourage people to come here. My grandparents were immigrants. My grandfather came over from the Netherlands on my mom's side, also on my dad's side. So I'm a family of immigrants, too. I mean, I'm only third generation here, so it's very important that we have a system that works for folks that they can use and not be frustrated by.
Would you get behind an effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act?
Well, a lot of these issues yet we're, still kind of looking at. I'm putting together my policy team and putting together my strategy team, and we want to take a look at some of these things. You know, we have a lot of issues that are out there that need to be addressed, and that's definitely something we will be doing.
That's been on the table a long time. No impulse, yes side of maybe, no side of maybe?
Well, one of the things I like to do is to talk to folks. And again, you bring up a good point about what's going on in the U.S. Senate right now, and I don't think people are talking to each other. I've always been, again, one that goes and talks to the legislature. When I was in Secretary of State, I had a Democrat governor, a Democrat legislature, and we still were able to pass legislation. We passed consolidated elections. We passed, as I mentioned, the enhanced driver's license. In fact, Senator Levin and Senator Debbie Stabenow both were very supportive of that. So, that's one of the things that I think we have to have in the U.S. Senate now, and in Congress for that matter, is we need to talk to folks, find out where they are in the issues, see if we can't come together on some of them, and be able to be successful for our citizens in our great country.
Can you identify any members of your team that will likely be a part of your team?
Well, as I mentioned, I just talked to Congressman Rogers last week. We just made the final decision that we were going to go, and he said he still was working on his timetable. So I haven't filed my campaign finance report. So as you can't spend any money or take in any money until July 1. So we're putting that paperwork together. Once we have that all done, we will definitely get that out to you.
Were you at Mackinac last week?
No, I was, again, I decided that it was more important to wait a little bit more for Congressman Rogers. I know he was there. He was on a panel, I understand, but he called me just before that, actually. That was when he called. And so at that point, I'd already committed to be up in Manistee at the Manistee County Republicans and was their dinner speaker there. So that was a commitment I'd had prior before that.
Well, thank you very much for making time for us, Terry Lynn Land, former Michigan Secretary of State and aspiring U.S. Senator from the state of Michigan for the Republicans. Terry Lynn Land, thank you.
Thank you. Hey, good talking to you. Thanks.
It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Drew Montree is the director of the Michigan Farmers Market Association. She's also co-owner of Bath, Michigan's Ten Hens Farm. As the Mid-Michigan Farmers Market season shifts into high gear in the coming weeks, WKAR's Peter Wharf talks with Drew about market trends and realities.
So I think one of probably the biggest misconceptions is about farmers markets is that people will look at a farmers market and they'll be like, oh, it just pops up, operates for 4 hours, pops down. That's got to be a piece of cake. And the reality is that it's not. It actually takes a lot of energy behind getting that market to operate the way that it does. And so it takes a lot of planning and making sure, kind of organization, to make sure those markets function.
What types of farmers are attracted to developing new markets and which are not?
Well, you know, to sell at a farmer's market, you have to have the personality and kind of the attitude that you want to be interacting directly with people. And farmers markets can be a great fit for a lot of people, but you need to be a people person, because one of the great things about farmers markets is that you get to interact with your customers directly, and your customers get to interact with you. And those interactions really kind of drive your sales. And so while farmers markets are a great opportunity to, you know, take home a larger portion of the food dollar, you're kind of cutting out the middleman, and they're really an opportunity to try new business ideas because they're pretty low risk in terms of, you know, low capital to get into. You also have to have the right type of personality to be in a situation where you're interacting directly with your customers the entire time that you're at the farmer's market.
Your farm is called Ten Hens?
Yeah, we're Ten Hens Farm in Bath, Michigan.
Talk to me about your personal experience with Ten Hens and local farmers markets.
My background is in horticulture, and I grew up knowing that that's kind of the route I would go. I've always loved gardening and knew that I wanted to scale up that experience. And my husband and I met at Michigan State. We worked in kind of the local foods arena in Pennsylvania for a few years, traveled after that, and through a program called WOOF, Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms. And so we got to work on other farms in the southwest on the Pacific coast of the country, and we came back knowing we wanted to start our own farm. So I work for the Farmers Market Association. My husband works for MSU in the horticulture department, and we bought our farm in 2007. And we grow vegetables year round. But the first addition to our farm was that my husband traded a woman he was building a hoop house for her, and she traded us 10 hens.
Right.
And so the first start at our farm were 10 hens.
But one was a rooster.
Exactly. We've never had 10 hens, right. Come to find out. So we had a rooster, and now we're down to 2 hens during the winter, but we have 2 little girls, so we're starting our flock over again in the spring.
Is what you're describing kind of a typical sized farm for being involved with local farmers markets?
Well, I think, when you look at the research on farmers markets, there's a lot of small-scale farmers that are selling to farmers markets, and those are typically between, 2 and 10 acres. That being said, there are also a number of larger farms, especially in Michigan, that are selling at farmers markets as well, and they do so on a much larger scale, with farmers markets being one part of kind of their direct marketing strategy. So we also work with farmers that have hundreds of acres that are selling to 20 markets a week, on a much larger scale. So that's not uncommon either. But across the board, I would say farmers markets are a really good entry point into the marketplace for smaller scaled farms.
Are there any of these sort of medium to larger sized farms that you've just described that did not work at all with farmers markets and then made a switch over exclusively?
I would say the answer is yes, but probably not exclusively.
Yeah.
And so there are a number of large-scale farms that are now looking at farmers markets as kind of a new marketing opportunity.
Right.
And so they're interested in farmers markets, but probably not exclusively. And to be honest, a lot of farms really have a number of different marketing outlets. So they're selling to farmers markets. They're selling through maybe a CSA, which stands for Community Supported Agriculture. They're selling to restaurants or to their local co-op or to small grocery stores. And so a lot of farmers, sell through a number of different outlets, farmers markets being one of them.
So it's about being not in just one market, but diversifying.
Yeah, and I think it's important. I mean, we talk a lot about diversified farming operations so that farmers are kind of spreading out the risk and not investing it all in one crop. It's a different model than kind of a monoculture farm where they're focusing on one crop. And that's kind of the same thing that you're doing with your market. You're not putting all your eggs in one basket, so to speak.
Are there any trends that you think we'll see?
People might see markets opening a little bit earlier. They also, you know, are really focused on diversifying their products. So you see fresh fruits and vegetables, but also, you know, baked goods, meats, cheeses, cut flowers, a lot of kind of variety in terms of being able to, different products to buy, especially a new kind of interest in ready-to-eat foods. Mm-hmm. More people are looking to farmers markets to have, you know, a food court section of the farmers market where they can go and have breakfast, lunch, or dinner, depending on when the market operates. And also a lot of interest in kind of special programs at farmers markets, special events, kids activities, music, entertainment, adding kind of another element that would make the farmers market a community gathering place.
Drew Montry is the director of the Michigan Farmers Market Association. Thanks for the conversation.
Thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR and at WKAR.org. Along with hundreds of other state officials, Michael Finney, CEO of the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, spent a few days last week at the Mackinac Policy Conference on Mackinac Island. The annual gathering offers decision makers from the public and private sectors a chance to connect with each other and learn more about the issues facing the state, along with possible remedies. After the conference, I caught up with Michael Finney and first asked him if there was a topic or discussion that he thought was worthy of more coverage than it got.
I think the fact that young people are really taking a close look at where employment opportunities are and making location decisions is something that's really important. That research came out of a study that was done by a number of different groups, but the University Research Corridor led
yeah.
it. Along with the Detroit Regional Chamber, the MEDC, and others. It was real important data because it suggested that we've now moved from, in round numbers, about 50% of our kids staying here to more than 60%. And so that was an important factor. And they're doing it because the jobs climate has improved so much.
Michigan's seasonally unadjusted unemployment rate in April stood at 8.4%. That's almost 3 percentage points lower than when Governor Snyder took office, but it's still frustratingly above the national average of 7.5%. What will it take to get Michigan closer, at least, to that national average?
Well, we've set a goal for ourselves of getting into the top 10 when it comes to having a lowest unemployment rate. And in order to do that, we still need to add about 150,000 jobs to our state if things were to stay static as of today. In other words, our state and all other states essentially stayed the same. We improved by 150,000 jobs. We would be in the top 10. So we have a long way to go. But the good news is that, you know, some 220,000 to 230,000 jobs have been created over the last 3 years. And that's an important data point that says we can continue to drive down the unemployment rate and get ourselves positioned to be one of the top 10 states.
What's happening right now at MEDC to speed that up?
Well, we're doing a lot. You know, our primary effort has centered around economic gardening. That was a term that we used going back to Governor Snyder first coming into office, and it had a number of components to it. It was about access to talent, access to capital, business-to-business connections, and so on. And on the major pieces, we're doing really well, which is access to capital and business-to-business connections. Some of our financial institutions are now investing, you know, billions of dollars in Michigan-based small and medium-sized companies that simply wasn't happening as a result of some of our partnering efforts with them. And then on the business-to-business piece, our two kickoff partners were DTE and Consumers Energy. They each committed $250 million of additional spending with Michigan-based companies. And at the Mackinac Policy Conference, they each increased their commitment fourfold to $1 billion each over a five-year period. Mm. So that kind of activity really drives an awful lot of jobs. That's the real point of it. And it was really important that they continue to expand their commitments.
The governor's office says there's about 56,000 job openings right now at mytalent.org. Talk to us about this perceived skills mismatch in Michigan. Is that improving as well, or where do we stand?
No, we still have a lot of work to do on the skills mismatch. The 56,000 is coming right out of job postings that we have on MI Talent. So businesses are posting jobs on a fairly regular basis now, and many of those are going unfilled. And it really covers the entire spectrum from low-skilled jobs to very highly skilled professional and technical jobs. We see an awful lot of need in the professional and technical space, positions that require, like skilled trades positions, whether it's welding, machinist trades, et cetera. We see an awful lot of opportunities there. And we're trying to work with our community colleges and our four-year schools, and frankly, even to some extent with K through 12, to ensure that young people who have an interest in vocational types of occupation understand the opportunities that are there with businesses in our state.
I'd like to revisit this issue of more college students staying in Michigan. Is that purely a factor of the number of jobs available, or are there other reasons they're staying behind as well?
Well, this was the first significant study that I've seen that really spoke to young people about their location decisions. And it was very clear, the Michigan students who are choosing to stay here versus looking at options in other places are staying because Michigan's job climate has improved fairly dramatically. And as a result, we saw, I think, a 13 percentage point improvement in the number of kids that are staying in Michigan versus exiting after graduating from our colleges and universities.
Lending to businesses and startups was extremely sluggish for some time as a result of the recession. Where is that now, and how big a factor is that in economic development in Michigan?
Yeah, I briefly mentioned earlier our economic gardening efforts, and a major component of that was access to capital. One of the things that we discovered early on was that banks simply weren't lending. Companies couldn't find the debt capital they needed to, you know, buy inventory, hire individuals, expand facilities, et cetera. And so we came up with a program that has since been scaled to the federal level called the State Small Business Credit Initiative, or SSBCI. And under that program, we have a pool of about $100 million total that we use as collateral support or to participate in loans with banks when our businesses are looking for debt. And the neat thing about it, it's our most active tool from an economic development standpoint. You would think that, you know, grants and other programs might be more readily available and more interesting, but because a loan tool provides capital immediately when companies need it, it has been highly effective. We're doing about one deal a day. The banks play a critical role because they do all the underwriting, and we simply participate either to cover collateral gaps that exist or to participate in the loan.
Explain the importance of the personal property tax here in Michigan and why MEDC supports its elimination.
Yeah, the personal property tax really serves as a disincentive for businesses to buy additional equipment and other personal property and have it located here in the state of Michigan. I came from the private sector, and each time we went out and bought another piece of equipment to expand our operations, that equipment was taxed as personal property. In many, many other states, you do not have a personal property tax on equipment. And as a result, companies are incentivized to locate expansions there versus here in Michigan. It's a very straightforward proposition. Now, there is a downside to eliminating it as well, in that those taxing jurisdictions in our state who have grown to depend on the personal property tax need to have some kind of an equitable fix to the change. And I'm not here to offer, you know, any opinions about what that fix ought to be, but I know that our governor and our legislative leaders are working on a fix so that local units of government or taxing jurisdictions will, in fact, be able to maintain their financial needs. But the importance of changing the message to the business community is one that we clearly support.
It's interesting because that decision will be in the hands of the voters here in about 18 months.
Yeah, my understanding is that you know, we're on a glide path right now to making the change to the personal property tax, and it should be one that will allow both communities and the business community to to enjoy the positive outcome as a result of the change.
Questions have been raised over the legality of the special assessment, which has been proposed as a means to raise that replacement revenue. Do you fear court involvement in this process?
Well, again, I'm not the expert in terms of what the ultimate solution will be or should be. There's a lot of folks much closer to that than I am, who I think would offer a lot more, strong opinions and, frankly, facts about it. But we are very supportive of the change because it will send the right kind of message to businesses that they should continue investing in the state of Michigan when they have expansion opportunities.
Some number of small businesses, not just in Michigan but across the country as well, are suggesting that because of the Affordable Care Act mandates about health insurance coverage, that they'll be forced to cut some employees' hours to below 30 hours a week. Is that a concern for MEDC?
Well, we've heard from a few businesses. It has not been an overwhelming number that I can say we've personally heard from, but they do express concerns. And we think that's an issue that, you know, those businesses really need to work to resolve and make decisions about with respect to the employment level of the individuals who work for them. It's not an issue that creates a competitive disadvantage for Michigan because it applies to all businesses in the United States. The issue has been, properly debated at every level right up to the Supreme Court. And so right now we're really trying to focus on business climate changes that can be affected at the state level to try and continue to help businesses to grow. So with small businesses in particular, we're trying to make it easier for them to get access to talent, access to capital, access to business services, business-to-business connections, because if we can continue to facilitate business growth in our state, issues like the Affordable Care Act and others that we literally have no control over because they're federally mandated at this point, we trust will not put our companies at a competitive disadvantage. And so our effort is really looking forward, trying to help businesses grow here using the tools that we have available to us.
Michael Finney is CEO of the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. Michael, thanks. Good to see you.
Thank you.
It's Current State on WKAR. Each year, billions of dollars of America's agriculture sector are the direct result of the work done by bees. Here in Michigan, blueberry, apple, and cherry growers, among others, count on bees to pollinate their crops. However, bee populations have been in slow decline across most of the United States. While it's not quite at crisis level yet, researchers led by MSU entomologist Rufus Isaacs are looking for strategies to ensure these master pollinators will not disappear. And Professor Rufus Isaacs joins us now to talk about the bee situation here in Michigan. Welcome, Rufus.
Hey, good morning, Mark.
Tell us a little bit more about how important bees are to Michigan agriculture.
Well, they provide a really important service to growers in the springtime when the crops are in bloom, especially the crops you just mentioned, the fruit crops that we love so much that bloom in May and June. Most of those crops require pollen to be moved from the male part of the flower to the female part, and it's bees that do that work. So we need all those bees to move all that pollen so that we can get the delicious fruits and vegetables later in the summer.
I understand, though, that wind, for example, can pollinate crops as well. What are some of the other ways? Are there many other ways besides insects and the wind?
There are many ways that plants and have evolved to be pollinated. So many plants, as you said, are pollinated by wind. We get those big bursts of pollen from pine trees that set off people's allergies, and that's pollen moving on the wind. Those plants use the wind to move the pollen, but the grasses also use wind, so all the wheat and you know, many of the grass crops that we rely on. But bees are very important for a lot of crops, but there's also birds. For example, you can think of some plants that are pollinated by hummingbirds moving the pollen around.
Yeah.
So it's not just bees, and there are also some plants that use water. Some aquatic plants use water to move the pollen.
How about that?
Around.
We have heard stories, of course, in recent years about the bees mysteriously dying off, colony collapse disorder.
Mm-hmm.
What's the situation like here in Michigan with regard to our state's bee population?
Well, there certainly are concerns in Michigan's beekeeping community with this issue. I hear variable reports from growers of their beekeepers saying that they've had issues with some declines. We've had some growers that have had weaker hives this spring, and that may be a result of some of the overwintering problems that the honeybees had. But in general, our agricultural community seems to be able to get plenty of hives. So even though there may be some declines during the winter, the beekeepers have the time and the skills to build up those numbers to have enough honeybee hives to pollinate the crop in the springtime.
Are harvesting bees more an issue for farmers? I mean, do more farmers actually actively cultivate bee populations?
I have heard of a few farmers who've had their maybe members of the family that they're interested in beekeeping, and so maybe the son or the daughter in the grower's family has taken on beekeeping as part of their contribution to the overall farm business. But I think in general, most growers that require pollination services are contracting with a beekeeper and having those colonies brought to the farm.
You know, I understand. That actually goes back for quite a while, I understand. Back to the 50s, farmers became quite aware that they had to supplement wild bees with colonies of bees.
Well, that was the case in the blueberry industry that I work mainly with in Michigan, where as that industry expanded and there were larger and larger farms, the background populations of native bees weren't abundant enough to keep up with the number of flowers that needed to be pollinated.
Mm-hmm.
I think you could go back earlier than that probably and find use of honeybees in other crops where it was known before.
How many species of bees do we have here in Michigan?
Well, it's funny you should ask, because currently we're trying to put that list together in my lab as part of our research here in Michigan, but it's about 400 species. So there's 20,000 species of bees in the world, approximately. And in Michigan here, we think somewhere between 350 or 400 species of bees.
I have to ask, how many of those 400 do you think you have encountered?
Probably.
It's the collector coming out in me here.
Probably about 100 or so.
100 of the 350 to 400. Mm. Are you good at identifying the common species?
I'm not the best person.
Okay.
For that, yes. We currently have a postdoctoral researcher, Jason Gibbs, in my lab, who's just joined us from Cornell, and he's our resident expert on that at the moment.
20,000 worldwide, though.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. Tell us about you have a research grant that I know is part of your work. You formed quite a few partnerships in it. This spans the country, these relationships you've developed. What role do you play in all of that?
Yeah, so we just recently received this large grant from the United States Department of Agriculture, and it's from their Specialty Crops Research Initiative. So it's a program within the USDA to fund research for fruit and vegetable and nut growers' problems and to try and solve those. So we have this team of people interested in pollination, crop pollination, native bees, the social side of it, and how we get information out to farmers and people involved in extension and outreach. And that group is working together on this project. And Michigan State University is the lead institution, so I have the role of coordinating this grant for the next 5 years, and we were successful in getting that just last year.
Have crop yields in Michigan, fruit crop yields, let's say, has there been a noticeable decline because of the bee population issues in
no, there
recent
hasn't.
Years?
No. No, there hasn't. In fact, depending on the crop, there has actually been some increases in production because of increased acreage. But like I said earlier, I think the honeybee keepers have been able to get their colonies strong enough for the demands that there are here in Michigan. And we're a relatively late part of the country to go into bloom, so they have time during the earlier part of the spring to build those colonies ready for the Michigan season. But there are many of Michigan's beekeepers that go to California and go to pollinate almonds out there in February and March. And this year there were stories coming back from California of insufficient numbers of honeybees available for the very large almond industry demand. So we're not seeing it in Michigan, but there are certainly situations within the country where there's a deficit of honeybees.
But in general, you would say the situation may not be as alarming as maybe we've been led to believe in the past?
Well, I think currently we have plenty of honeybees, and there are no long-term surveys of wild bees in Michigan to know whether we really are seeing a decline there. As I said, we don't have a deficit in terms of pollination for the crop producers at the moment, but we are, as part of this grant, we're thinking long-term and thinking ahead to, you know, what would happen if these multi-million dollar industries in our state were limited in the number of honeybees or other bees that they could get. What can we do proactively to make sure that situation doesn't happen here and make sure that we can guarantee good yields every spring for those growers?
What about climate change? Are you seeing an impact on Michigan's bee population for that reason?
Well, that's something that's likely to happen if it does over a very long period. And like I said, we don't have a long-term monitoring program to be able to answer that question. We have seen some individual bees that we've collected in Michigan seem to be much further north than their historical range would have predicted. So it's possible that there are some movements of bees north into areas that they previously wouldn't have been able to survive, but that's just a very, very small proportion of the community of bees that we have here.
You speak with gardening groups, I'm told. Is there a lot of interest in bees out there among these groups?
There's a huge amount of interest. The gardeners have been a very welcoming and enthusiastic group when we've been to speak to them about issues related to pollinators and conservation. And obviously a gardener has control over just a small piece of land usually, but there's a lot you can do in a garden to enhance its support for those 400 species of bees that we have in Michigan.
It strikes me as kind of a cult activity almost. Friends of mine became beekeepers not too long ago, and they're way into it. What is the appeal of this, do you think, for people?
Well, I've also seen that increase in interest in beekeeping in the urban environment, and I think people are concerned generally when they hear about the declines, the stories in the news that you mentioned earlier about the declines in bees, and maybe keeping bees in your own piece of land is a way that you can contribute just your own little piece to trying to keep the bees healthy.
We're talking with Rufus Isaacs, who's an MSU entomologist who works on honeybees and the bee pollination here in the state. You have an event coming up, Bee-a-Palooza. Tell us about that.
So this is the second annual Bee-Palooza.
Oh.
We've done this just once before, did this last year, and the third week of June is National Pollinator Week. So there's a big effort nationally to have events around the country that highlight the plight of bees and get the public thinking about this issue some more. So as part of that, on Sunday, the 23rd of June, we have an event from 1 to 4 o'clock in the afternoon over in the MSU Horticulture Demonstration Gardens. And that's just at the corner of Wilson and Bogue on the MSU campus. And so as part of that, we have stations that people can go to. This is a free event, and you can come and learn about the bees of Michigan. You can learn about gardening with native plants for bees. You can learn about honeybees. Learn about building a bee nest for your own garden to support native pollinators. And there's also a stall where we talk about the link between people's food and pollinators. Most people don't realize that things like coffee and chocolate are dependent on pollination. So there's some really important connections here.
You just got a lot of people's attention just with that comment.
And we also we have a very kid-friendly event. So we also have a scavenger hunt, and we'll have face painting too. So bring your family, and hope to see you at the MSU Demonstration Gardens there on the 23rd.
Very good. Professor Rufus Isaacs is an entomologist here at Michigan State University. Thanks, Rufus.
Thank you. Thank you.
The festival season has begun in Michigan, from the Cherry Festival in Traverse City to the Great Lakes Folk Festival in East Lansing to Langsburg's renowned Festival of the Golosh. Large and small towns host unique events to bolster civic pride and tourism, and most importantly, to have a good time. One of the more unusually named festivals is this weekend in Potterville, and WKAR's Melissa Benmark recently talked to the director of the Gizzard Fest about the event.
My name is Joe Bristol. I am the chairperson of the Gizzard Fest Committee and the president of the Potterville Chamber of Businesses.
And the owner of?
And the owner of Joe's Gizzard City as well.
How long has Gizzard's Fest been going on in Potterville?
This is our 14th year of Gizzard Fest.
Which is pretty amazing. A lot of festivals haven't ridden out the economy so well. So what do you think just keeps people coming back?
You know, I think it's the name is something unique. It's fresh. People like things that are different. We try to keep the new events coming in yearly, and so it doesn't get boring. And I don't know how other events do what they have to do, but we have a good service community around here to keep it thriving.
I noticed there's a major lawnmower racing component. Now, is that like specifically a Potterville thing, or how did that happen to be part of this?
Actually, I think this lawnmower thing is getting bigger and bigger throughout the surrounding cities. And there's different locations that they do they're racing at. Not unlike local sprint car racing and such, it's starting to get to be a big league.
Presumably they do something in terms of doctoring. It's not just your average off the floor lawnmower.
No, they're actually souped up lawnmowers. And I think they get to up at least 25, 30 miles an hour on a dirt track. And I could be wrong, could be faster than that. But they are definitely not your average lawnmower.
You have a gizzard eating contest. What kind of participation do you have in that?
We limit the participation to 12 people. It can be all ages and boys and girls, and the first person to finish 2 pounds of gizzards, so it's the fastest 2 pounds of gizzards, wins the coveted Gizzard Fest Champion title. And they get their name on a plaque, and again, $100 bill, and a trophy with a chicken on top.
Are there sort of reigning champions, or do you see new folks every year?
We've had a couple different people over the last 14 years that have been sharing the title back and forth year to year. Last two years we had a couple new winners.
So as the supplier of the gizzards for the Gizzard Fest, what makes a delicious gizzard?
A delicious gizzard is, in my opinion, you have to have them very tender, and you have to have the proper seasoned batter. And we have a Joe's Famous Batter Mix, which I think keeps ours separate from many around the nation.
Did you eat them as a kid?
I believe they probably pureed them and put them in my milk. I don't know. I think I was bred for this. But yes, I did.
How did you end up then going into it as a business?
Well, it's a third-generation business. My grandfather, Ron and Ruby, grandfather, grandmother, first opened it in 1960. Then my mom and dad took it over. Now it's my fault.
Is this good gizzard weather, a little bit cool like this, or?
I think this is perfect. I mean, we've had many years of dealing with rain or intense heat. I think 70-degree weather is a perfect with sunshine. I think it should be a great weekend for it.
Do we have a gizzard king and queen?
There is no Gizzard Fest king or queen. However, my business, Joe's Gizzard City, does put our parade entrance. We have a Gizzard Fest princess. And we've went through, this is probably our, if you include Potterville days, about 18 different gizzard princesses. We'd like to maybe one day get them back all together. But as of right now, those princesses are either family members or friends of the family or people that work for us, their children.
How long of days do you put in going into it and during the festival?
Each day, starting on Friday, I'm probably here from 5 in the morning till 2 o'clock at night. The next morning, each day. So it's quite a long weekend for me, but it's worth it.
Well, I hope you have wonderful weather, and Joe Bristol, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you stopping by.
Potterville's Gizzard Festival is June 7th through 9th, and you can find out more information at gizzardfest.com. For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark. And no, I did not leave Joe's Gizzard City without some heavy-duty research of the subject. Okay, so here we go, my first gizzard.
Oh, I like that a lot.
You do?
It reminds me of just everything I like about dark meat chicken.
Okay.
But just a little more just rich.
Okay.
But the seasoning is just lovely. These are tasty. Where have I been?
Oh, it's Gizzardlicious. Thanks for joining us today on Current State. Coming up tomorrow, we'll remember the Flint Beecher tornado, which struck 60 years ago this Saturday. Also, local musician Eldon Kelly will play for us all in studio and give us a taste of this weekend's Pump Stock Festival in East Lansing, which will feature American roots music, that and more, Friday on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks as well to Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Becky McKendry for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.